How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. We have an international perspective in this episode who is a leader in genetics in Qatar. We previously talked to the first certified genetic counselor who practiced in Qatar, Shanila Lakhani, in episode 109, which was many years ago at this point. But if you haven't yet, I really encourage you to check that interview out. Shanila is amazing. She actually ended up being one of my supervisors during my education. But in this interview, we are honored to have the director of the Qatar Genome Program, which is part of the Qatar Foundation, Dr. Saeed Ismail. Dr. Ismail was pivotal to the establishment of the Qatar Genome Program, a groundbreaking genome sequencing initiative that started in 2015. And get this, it's the largest program of its kind in the Middle East. The Qatar Genome Program was the first whole genome sequencing operation in the region to study genomes from people from Qatar and Arab countries. So, Dr. Ismail, thank you so much for coming on. We have quite a lot to talk about today.
Thank you very much, Kira. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I wanted to kind of start by obviously talking about the Qatar Genome Program and learning a little bit more of its significance in the context of genomic research in the Middle East. I mean, as I mentioned, it's the largest project of its kind in the Middle East to give people an awareness of just how significant this is. But provide us a little bit more information here.
Absolutely. So when we sequenced the first genome in 2015, I mean, we knew that we have a huge mission on our shoulders, not to only represent Qataris. It's a small nation on the Gulf, but we knew that we live in a largely underrepresented part of the world, the Middle East. And we knew that we are basically laying the foundations of a lot of work to come. And we knew that what we do here has such great value because you know how important it is to increase the diversity of genetic data being produced. And we all know that the vast majority of such data is basically for people of Caucasian, North European ancestry, and there's plenty to be discovered, there's plenty to be unveiled, I mean, if by studying such other populations, largely underrepresented populations. So in that context, the Qatar Foundation launched this very ambitious project. In the vision was announced by Her Highness Sheikha Moza bint Nasser in 2013, end of 2013, beginning of 2014. The first genome was sequenced in 2015, and now we are at just over 45,000 whole genome sequenced there. A couple of years before we launched the Qatar Genome Project, Qatar also launched another ambitious project called the Qatar Biobank, and so we were not sequencing samples in vacuum. We were sequencing samples from the Qatar Biobank, where one of the most extensive phenotyping took place, and we also now are linking this huge data set to electronic medical records. So in that sense, I'm telling you, we have one of the biggest data, health-related data sets related to the Middle Eastern populations. Whole genome sequencing at 30x, very rich phenotypic data from the Qatar Biobank, and access to electronic medical records for a largely, as I said, underrepresented population.
It's really impressive just how many. You said 45,000, I think you said. And yes, That's just in, you know, just shy of 10 years. So that is just mind-boggling that you've been able to sequence these genomes at 30x, as you said, So a lot of, you know, depth there in coverage and just how much information you're able to glean from this. We're going to dive into a little bit more. But I mean, as the director of the Qatar Genome Program, what inspired you to join such a groundbreaking genome sequencing initiative? Because obviously this is so important. And I also wanted to pull out something else that you said that we've talked about a lot on this show, is that a lot of the context for how genetics started in terms of sequencing, once we got to that point in genetics, genomics, it was based a lot on European genomes. And we've talked about how that really creates so many downstream effects of disparity, because people that do not have more European ancestry don't have that database to look at certain variants and everything. So did this play a role at all in terms of inspiring you to really join this initiative?
Absolutely. I mean, when I received the invitation to be part of the small team, then just few handful of people planning the establishment of the Qatar Genome Project, I didn't think twice. I've seen the, I could foresee the potential of such a huge initiative, a very ambitious one, and the impact on the, not only the research landscape in the Middle East, but also the future clinical implementation, and how impactful that would be, not only, as I said, on the research side, but actually changing the course of future clinical healthcare in the region. I am sure no one will do it for you if you don't produce enough data on behalf of your population here. I mean, it's not going to happen. It doesn't travel well if you just go and study or get, I mean, work on data produced on Northern Europeans or Far Eastern, yeah, Asians. It's not going to be very useful for you. So again, Qatar is a place with this ambition to become a hub for research and education and innovation and all that. And it's a place where a critical mass of researchers have assembled, I mean, around this project and took it on its shoulders to as again, play that role on behalf of the Middle East. So I couldn't miss seeing the great opportunity of being part of such very, very ambitious project.
And as we said, you've been doing this for almost 10 years. What are some key insights or discoveries that have started to emerge from this initiative and all of this data? Or are you still at the point of just collecting the data and haven't analyzed too much? Because again, you know, it's a lot of data to be sorting through. So there's stages to this.
Absolutely. I mean, we already started analyzing, and we do it, if you wish, let me call it in waves. We've analyzed the first 6,000 genomes, and then we released 15K, and in the coming couple of months, we are going to release 30,000 whole genomes. I mean, with the related, of course, phenotypic and data. We don't wait till we collect the 100K. That's our overall target, 100,000 whole genomes. But every year or two, we have this release where we make the data we produced available for researchers to mine and come up with very useful discoveries. And if I'm just to throw some of these insights we've had from the first wave of such papers that were published in high impact journals, I mean, paper on population substructure by Yunus Mukrab and colleagues proved what we've already anticipated, that we are largely underrepresented in global databases. When we compare the data produced here on from a population structure point of view, we prove that indeed we're not as represented as you would want. The Middle East, I mean, there are 400 to 500 million people living in that part of the world. So, and this is as we called it in one of our publications, the first cradle out of Africa. I mean, that's the first cradle for humanity when they left Africa, Eastern Africa in particular. They went to that part of the Arabian Peninsula, stayed there for a long while, and then spread all over the place, north, west, and east. And so this is a very important population to study. And the results, we have so many of those, and the publications are coming every now and then to tell that this exercise was very useful. For example, there was no GWASs on behalf of this population, the Middle East, so far. I mean, there's a paper that just came out a couple of months ago saying that out of all GWAS studies performed on Middle Eastern populations, 96.2 of participants or genomes came from our study, the Qatar Genome Project. Wow. 3.8 came from all other studies around the region. So this is really important. And of course, there are so many other very important insights that we got. For example, 2.3 of our population carry a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant of in one of those ACMG genes. 99.5% of our cohort have at least one pharmacogenomic actionable mutations in some of our papers. So 3.6 of those for 13 drugs per patient. And familial cancers, there's a very important paper that came out by Lutfi Shoshan, one of our PIs, that basically described the landscape of all familial cancer causing mutations in our population. And that was so important that even Lancet Oncology gave us the cover, for that issue, realizing the importance of adding such diversity to the global data set. So yes, the first wave of papers just proved what we already anticipated, that what we're doing here in Qatar is basically laying the foundations of future, of course, continuous research projects, but also implementation, whether it's at the pharmacogenomics side, whether it's polygenic risk scores, or whether it's familial cancer causing mutations or ACMG genes and the rest. So there's so many little stories here and there that are outlined in our papers.
Yeah, it just impacts so much in so many different areas of healthcare. I love just how many examples you were able to give in that. In order for people to have the ability to have personalized medicine, precision medicine, we need to be able to understand, okay, these are the variants that we're seeing in certain populations, and this is what these variants mean. Because I think a good example, you were kind of talking about the cancer space a little bit, of in the BRCA genes 1 and 2 were some of the first, that's why they're called BRCA, breast cancer, the first identified to be like, okay, if there is a pathogenic variant there, it's going to increase someone's risk for cancer. And the three variants that we are most familiar with are very common in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. But what about for people that have ancestry from Qatar and these other areas in the Middle East that we don't necessarily have that data, but now we are starting to have this data because of you and your colleagues? So I think that's just so important, because before this, I imagine a lot of people, if they were doing genetic testing, would have these results and say, okay, well, we didn't find any pathogenic variants, but that very well could be they found something called a variant of uncertain significance, but they weren't able to say, oh, well, actually, this is a pathogenic variant, because there wasn't any data to back that up. So that is just huge. The downstream effects to this is just, and that's just cancer. You're talking about pharmacogenomics. And I think I'm coming from the prenatal area of carrier screening and in so many different areas. And this is just so important. I think one question I have with this is, how have you been able to get to 45,000 genomes? What is the process of being able to have samples from people, get their consent, and then, start processing this? Because this is a huge undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely. So the vision that when Qatar Genome was launched is to basically, in the first couple of years, to be incubated basically within the Qatar Biobank, and then continue to work very, very closely together. And the Qatar Biobank has got the population trust in a way. So let me tell you that this very interesting initiative that was launched in 2012 started to with modest starts, few participants here and there. But at one stage, they were doing such a good job that there was, I think, at least 5,000 participants on their waiting lists, relying only on a word of mouth. Wow. And they stopped even marketing for that. So the way they did it at Qatar Biobank is that they did give something back to the participant. The participant would sign a consent form that will say that, for example, for genomic data, I don't have to, as Qatar Genome, give them back anything, but we were proactively trying to pay back for them. And for example, you just mentioned the BRCA1. We sat together at one stage a couple of years ago and said, we know that there are dozens of ladies in our cohort who do carry that mutation, and we have to do something about that. Although our consent does not oblige us to do so, but we proactively sort of designed a workflow whereby we can call those at risk of being carriers of BRCA1 or 2, reconsent them, and then confirm the result in a CAB accredited lab. And then if it was really there, we would just channel them through the right clinical pathway within the healthcare system. That was the latest example of how Qatar Genome and Qatar Biobank sort of gained the trust of the population. In other examples, I can tell you that many of those participants were referred to different sorts of all sorts of clinics within the healthcare system, because we work very closely with the main healthcare provider, Hamad Medical Corporation, for all sorts, for diabetes, for bone density issues and osteoporosis and all that. And little by little, this just word of mouth and the good treatment they get when they spend 3 hours, by the way, at the biobank, very extensive data collection, but apparently the treatment they get there and what they get after the visit from the reports and the counseling, the referral mechanisms we have there, meant that we do have their support, and we got to that number, 45,000. And I think now we're shifting gears from being just sequencing, or mainly sequencing our population cohort, into more disease cohorts. I think we've now sort of reaching the point where we've sequenced enough individuals to basically know exactly or capture most of the landscape of variants that are there here in this population, and think it's about time to focus more on national priority diseases, as we call them here.
Yeah, it's very exciting just how much you've been able to progress in these years. And I love your example with the BRCA of saying, okay, we can actually look at this and then also then confirm that finding, because what you're doing is more of like on the research side of doing this genomic sequencing. But if you find a variant, you're saying that you also then confirm that again.
It was a very pleasant surprise, by the way, that we've had almost 100% concordance between the result from that research environment, whole genome sequencing result, and that CAB accredited targeted sequencing. So that exercise gave us some very important information, which is that our research level sequencing is really good enough.
Yeah, that your research level really is kind of clinical level in terms of having 100%. That means that of the variants you found, when you went to confirm that, it 100% of the time, every time, confirmed it. So that is definitely reassuring of looking at that and seeing that it's very accurate. And how empowering that so many people are interested in this, and that you said it's mostly word of mouth. I mean, that is just incredible. Are there certain things that you hear from people in terms of why they want to be part of this? Is it mostly to be contributing in terms of like contributing to research in the community? Or do you find it's a lot of people that are more prioritizing, well, I can learn information about myself and my family?
It's both. We actually conducted a survey, a national level survey, to confirm what we felt when we interacted with all those participants. And the results of those surveys actually confirm both what you've just very well articulated here. A good majority of them are very much interested in donating samples for research purposes, even knowing that they wouldn't get everything that is there in, within their genomes. And actually, in those surveys, when asked, it's a very long survey with so many questions they were asked. But the last one was, are you just willing to give donate a sample for something called Qatar Genome Project? And that would your data would be available for researchers, of course, de-identified. But any research or any outcomes that will be of clinical importance might take so many years. And 71% said, yes, even if that is a long path ahead, and even if I wouldn't have an immediate benefit from that, I am still willing to donate that sample, which was very empowering. And the other thing is because of this, the few referrals that we do within Qatar Genome, Qatar Biobank, for some of them, it was a checkup, basically. It was a medical checkup. They would go there and get VIV treatment and get 66 blood markers, ECG, retinal imaging, and recently sometimes for some of them, full body MRI. So and in many cases, there are established referral mechanisms from that biobank to the healthcare system within Qatar. It's a small country with the state-of-the-art healthcare system. So this is also very helpful. It's not like you're in a huge country with scattered any healthcare services. So this is one advantage we have here in Qatar.
Yeah, I can see that that's an advantage in the sense that you already have that pathway set up of, okay, when this happens and we find a variant, we're then going to confirm that. And then let's say going with our cancer example, then they'd be referred to a cancer specialist, an oncologist, and other team members there. But one question I have with all that is, I mean, as I mentioned at the top of the show a few years ago, we had Shanila Lakhani on, who I don't know if you personally know her.
Of course, yes, I do.
Okay, I figured it's a small field, yes. Right, out there. So, yes. I mean, even in the U.S., I feel like it's a small field. But I mean, how does that work? Because you're talking about all of this amazing accomplishments you guys have had. I can't stop saying it, 45,000 genomes, and you guys are looking at that 100,000 as your goal in the next, X amount of years or whatever. But you only have so many people in healthcare, especially so many people in genetics. So how are you able to process all this information and be educating patients and everything when you have a small number of people that are specialized in genetics? Is it a lot of training other healthcare providers to be like, hey, you got to learn about this part because there's only so many of us in genetics that work in Qatar?
Spot on, Kira. So this is why early on, even before sequencing the first genome, in the 2014 and 2015, we knew that once we start producing that much of that big data set, we need people to be able to digest it first on the research level, and then people who are capable of translating these discoveries and outcomes and results into clinical practices. So this is why very early on in our program, we initiated a couple of graduate programs and encouraged others within the education system here in Qatar. For example, we partnered with Qatar University to launch one of the very few genetic counseling MSc programs in the region. And Qatar's vision is to become a pioneer in the implementation of precision health, as I always put it, we need a small army of genetic counselors who are at the forefront or the interface between clinicians, scientists, and patients. So we started also another graduate program, an MSc PhD in partnership with HBKU, Hamad bin Khalifa University, in genomic and precision medicine, with different tracks focusing on all sorts of different subspecialties that would basically provide the workforce, the people who will be able to digest the data we produce. And the bigger the data, of course, the more we need to that. And of course, we've opened it up for international collaborations. We have a good critical mass of researchers here in Qatar, geneticists, but we always encourage them to reach out to their international partners to work on the data. So did we get enough yet? And I think we have a critical mass, as I said, but do we need more? Of course, yes, we do.
Yeah, that's so important just to be able to work with other people internationally, because it all comes down to there are people that are from Qatar that then live in other countries and are going to get healthcare and going to do genetic testing. So throughout the world, we need to have these data banks and share data from my perspective so that we can have this robust database so that when we do genetic testing, we are then pulling and comparing it to a huge database. Because as you've been saying, you've kind of reached this critical mass, which is important, but the more data, the better, because then it's really much more informed. If you do a survey of 10 people, that's not going to be as reflective of the population as if you do a survey of 1 million people, right? So it's kind of looking at those kind of numbers. And one thing I was thinking about before our conversation today, and I did a little bit of research. I read a 2013 study that I'll link in the show notes, as well as the studies that you mentioned, Dr. Ismail. But that in Qatar, the prevalence of consanguineous marriages among married couples is about 62% is what I was reading. And most of those are first cousins. So how does the rate of consanguinity play a role in the prevalence of genetic conditions? And how does this play a role in terms of like the data sets you're looking at? Because this is higher than I would say the average country in the world.
It is high across the region. Some studies is 50% more or less, but it is high compared to other places. This would mean that we have a chance here for some breakthrough discoveries when it comes to rare disease, and we've realized that potential. And this is why some of our researchers here in the research ecosystem here in Qatar are focusing on that, and in collaboration with our partners at Sidra Medicine. Sidra Medicine is one of those big tertiary centers focusing on childhood disorders, and they have a good research arm looking into that. So we do realize that the cohort we have here could be very useful, not only for Qatar and the region, but also globally, because you have a higher concentration of such mutations or variants that are related to those rare diseases. So we do have a very strong interest in rare disease research to basically build on that.
Yeah, and in terms of rare disease too, even obviously it's really important to look at that rare disease and say, okay, how much can we learn about this? And then, continue on with research and treatment development and all that. But also so many rare diseases, when we learn about them, we can then apply what we've learned to very general conditions or conditions that affect much more people. Now, rare diseases affect 1 in 10 people, at least in the US kind of thing. So, I would think in other countries it's more, other countries are less. So even just within rare diseases, it's important. But for some people that are like, well, rare diseases, any one rare disease doesn't affect that many people, which, I'd argue on that point in terms of the importance of it. But also there are things that, we could learn possibly that help us with learning about heart disease, diabetes, things that are affect, millions and millions of people. So I think this is just, so important in so many different aspects. I'm just so intrigued by this and just, I can't say enough. I'm so impressed, Dr. Ismail, that you've been able to really lead this effort in learning so much. And there is so much left to learn. I think that's kind Absolutely. Of always the case in genetics, Absolutely. Right? Any final thoughts that you kind of wanted to end us out with?
Just to say that, actually, I'll just start from what you've just said. There's plenty more to do. I mean, the more we do, the more we discover that there's still to be done, and the bigger the data is. And now with our efforts to link with electronic medical records and with our efforts to sequence more disease cohorts, we do have a lot of work ahead of us. And one very important thing we just started a couple of years ago is that we started to sequence non-Qatari samples. We call them the LTRs, long-term residents. And anyone who stayed that number of years in Qatar, and most of those actually are Arabs, Middle Easterns. So we do now have a big data set belonging not only to Qataris, but people from all around the region, all the way from North Africa, Morocco, all the way to Iraq, the Levant, Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and so in the coming months or years, we do plan to expand on that angle and engage more researchers from the region and those who can't basically have such data from their own population. There's a very diverse expat community here in Qatar, and that enabled us to sequence representative samples, as I said, from the whole region. This is a huge part of the world. 400 to 500 million people live in this part of the world. And as I said, I couldn't stress it more that as that paper who said that we produce more GWAS studies than the rest of the Middle East described it, it's really very, very underrepresented, this part of the world. And so I couldn't but be excited about the opportunities to come. And the other big thing that we are interested in addition to sequencing other samples for representing the whole region, is we're shifting gears now more also towards clinical implementation. The knowledge we have accumulated during the past few years enabled us now to go and talk to our clinical partners and tell them, look, we can do that. We can help you in some pharmacogenomic testing, a point of care, genotyping of the genes affecting warfarin or clopidogrel metabolism. And so you can basically optimize the dose for your patient way quicker, and in some cases cut the hospitalization time from 7 days to 3 days, because you were able to reach that therapeutic window much quicker based on this information that we provided you, and that genotyping sort of point of care genotyping assay that we worked with you as a clinical care provider in this pilot. And this, so we have like 4 or 5 different clinical implementation pilots going through the healthcare system, and our clinical partners are excited about scaling up later on. So to cut a long story short, what is exciting for us ahead is more diverse data set representing with more representation from the whole region. And the other thing is clinical implementation.
I think that is just beautiful, and just how thrilling that we're at the point that we're at with all of this data and so much more to come. And I think that clinical utility there of what we can actually use with this data to affect people's lives in such a positive way is just so exciting. So thank you so much, Dr. Ismail, for coming on, explaining all this, but more importantly, doing all the work. I think this is just amazing. And I think we'll have to have you back on when you hit that 100K number, because there'll be even more to talk about. I think that should be like a part 2.
Will be a pleasure, Kira.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Ismail.
Thank you.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.